From California to Florida, Massachusetts to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Facebook is under fire over privacy concerns, but surveillance by the federal government is actually a bigger problem. Abigail Hall, author of Tyranny Comes Home, is here to discuss. The equity markets have been highly volatile the past couple of months. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on why fears of a trade war are fueling market concerns. A number of states have taken steps to reform asset forfeiture laws. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Lee McGrath of the Institute for Justice. And a former CIA director is attacking President Trump, which is interesting considering he once voted for the Communist Party nominee for president. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Concerns over personal privacy on social media sites like Facebook have arisen in the wake of news that Cambridge Analytica used data gleaned from those sites to micro-target voters in the 2016 presidential election. The U.S. government, however, has used that and other methods for domestic surveillance. Abigail Hall is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Tampa, and she is co-author of the new book, Tyranny Comes Home, The Domestic Fate of U.S. Militarism. She is here to talk about privacy issues. Abby, welcome to American Radio Journal. Abby, in recent weeks, there has been a lot of controversy over Cambridge Analytica and them getting information from Facebook, concerns about personal privacy. But is any of this really all that new?
Start just with a bit of a brief background about what is going on with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. Is on March 17th, the London Observer and the New York Times reported that Cambridge Analytica, which is a UK-based company, had acquired millions of Facebook users' personal information. And their goal was to build software that could target potential swing voters in political campaigns. This is particularly germane, and the controversy is really surrounding the most recent presidential election in which Donald Trump was elected. But certainly, this is not the first time that we see the use of new technology in ways that people find questionable, let's say, at best, domestically.
This, of course, says, as you've mentioned, it's created quite an uproar. But when we look back to 8 years ago when Barack Obama was running for president, his campaign was especially groundbreaking in the use of analyzing data and using it for micro-targeting. And, of course, the mainstream media thought this was just fantastic and was the future of campaigns. But when the Trump campaign used it, now all of a sudden it's bad. Is it just a political perception by the mainstream media, or in this case, did Cambridge Analytica do something that was too far?
I think it might be a little bit of both. So I think that the political climate in the United States right now is certainly giving people a lot to be upset about, and a lot of people certainly are upset, whether rightly or wrongly is a question for debate. But I think that other people are genuinely angry at Facebook and that they were not expecting and did not consent to have their data, or at least they didn't feel that they had consented to have their data sent off to a third-party company and to be used in this particular way. So now you have people using the hashtag delete Facebook. People are deleting their accounts. Mark Zuckerberg is supposed to testify in front of Congress about what happened, which will be new in that previously when Facebook has been called up on Capitol Hill, he's typically not been present. So I think it's a bit of both.
When we look at domestic surveillance, Congress itself recently reauthorized the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, and talk a little bit about what was contained in that act, because whereas Cambridge Analytica and Facebook are private sector surveilling us, the government has a pretty big role in surveilling Americans too, does it not?
Yes. The American government collects a mass amount of data on U.S. citizens. And this is something that has come to light recently and historically. Most recently, people remember the Snowden revelations in which it was brought to light just how much data was being collected on U.S. citizens. But actually, if we look back at surveillance in the United States, government collection of individuals' data actually goes back much, much further.
Let's talk a little bit more about the history of government surveillance. Can you go back to how all of this started? I assume there was a time in our republic where the government didn't keep track of what private citizens were doing domestically. How did we ease into and then take off in terms of this surveillance that's now all too common?
Well, there are a number of different factors that we can look at in this story. But one place that's really interesting and perhaps not a place that many people would think of in terms of place to look is actually foreign intervention. So U.S. government engaging in foreign activities abroad and then those techniques winding up being used domestically. And so one place that we can actually look for the origin of this, or at least a big part of it, is the U.S. war with the Philippines, which for historical context was 1898 to, I believe, 1901. And what you have there is you have the development of this advanced, for the time, security apparatus in which telegram lines are tapped, adversaries or other people who are dissenting against the U.S. occupations were being monitored, surveilled. They were engaging in various campaigns to harm people's assets or their reputations. And then you see that the people who were involved in engaging in those particular operations wound up coming back to the United States and suggesting that similar operations be used domestically. And ultimately, they were successful. So you see the creation of things like the Military Intelligence Division on the heels of the Philippine occupation, which includes a lot of those technologies that were first developed and pioneered in the Philippines.
Talk a little bit more then about the FISA Act. Was it not initially enacted into law by Congress in order to put some constraints on this domestic surveillance, and where has it gone to from there?
You're absolutely right. So the original intention of FISA was to constrain the government. The idea was that they would have to go to the court in order to be able to actually engage in lawful surveillance activities. But in reality, as opposed to really serving as a check on government, it's effectively been a rubber stamp. If you look at the number of FISA cases or FISA when they've gone and asked to surveil people, you look at the number of times that the FISA court has actually denied those, it's really insignificant. So most of the time these are approved. You also don't have someone there defending themselves in terms of why they should not have their data collected by government. So while it may give the appearance of providing some kind of protection against predatory behavior against U.S. citizens, it effectively hasn't done that.
We have been talking with Abigail Hall, who is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Tampa. She is co-author of the new book, just out a couple of days, Tyranny Comes Home, The Domestic Fate of U.S. Militarism. And Abby, tell us where folks can go if they want to learn more about the book, where they can go to purchase it if they're interested in reading up on this subject.
So perhaps the easiest place to go if they're interested in purchasing the book is Amazon.com, so they can type in the title of the book, or they can type in my name or Christopher J. Coyne, my co-author's name, and it should pop up. Or they can alternatively go to Stanford University Press's website, and they can get information about the book, they can get reviews, and they can actually start reading the first chapter.
Abigail Hall, co-author of Tyranny Comes Home, The Domestic Fate of U.S. Militarism. Abby, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Andy Roth is at the offices of the Club for Growth. He keeps an eye on what's happening on Capitol Hill. He keeps an eye on political races. He keeps an eye on the economy. We're going to talk about all of that today. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
The big news this past week has been wild swings in the markets. What is driving all of this volatility in the markets this past week?
Well, as you recall, this all started over a month ago when President Trump announced that he was putting a tariff on all steel and aluminum imports. And this caused the market to quickly dive, and that spooked a lot of people. The administration subsequently exempted basically all countries, by my count at least, 70% of all of the countries, so that it was mainly, at the end of the day, targeted just towards China and Japan. So the markets rebounded, and they were saying, okay, well, maybe this isn't so bad. It's just against China. It's just steel and aluminum. It's just against Japan. I think this is going to be okay. We've got this huge tax cut that is giving us a great tailwind and is giving us all the more reason to just continue to surge forward. So I think we're okay. But then Trump came out with $50 billion worth of goods that he was going to target with tariffs against China alone. And that caused the market to tumble yet again. Worse is that China retaliated, and they have targeted a bunch of U.S. goods. And this has, of course, all the markings of a trade war, which was thoroughly predicted. And this is why the stock market continues to tumble. I just saw that the stock market is 10% off of its all-time high. I don't have the math in front of me, but the U.S. market capitalization, which is the amount of wealth in the stock market, that number is in the trillions, like trillions and trillions. And so if you're off 10%, that means the market has destroyed some order of trillions of dollars in wealth. Now, we know we're not supposed to look at these things day to day, but this is partly how the Great Depression started, was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act placed tariffs on all sorts of things. Foreign countries retaliated, and it either started the Great Depression or exacerbated it. I think scholars debate that, but it certainly destroyed a ton of wealth. So I think this needs to be quickly resolved if we want the economy to return back to normal.
Certainly a trade war is in nobody's best interests. But Andy, if we look back to the presidential election of 2016, there was a significant run-up in the stock market from the day after the president was elected through the volatility that started back in January. Are investors still ahead of the game in terms of the period of time that the president has been in office?
Yeah, they are. But I think that for political purposes, the chief concern is what is the stock market, what is the economy going to look at like this fall when Republicans are trying to save their majorities in the House and the Senate? Like I said, they had that huge tailwind with the tax cut back in December, and that further ignited the economy. But if you dilute that or stall that economic recovery with a trade war, then you're destroying a lot of the growth that you were creating. We didn't experience 3% GDP growth under Obama at all for 10 years, or 8 years of Obama, and I believe the last 2 years of the Bush administration. And before and during the tax cut debate, we were starting to see 3% growth. And it would be a wonderful, joyous thing if we could have sustained 3% growth. But a trade war is going to diminish that. The thing that the stock market hates more than anything is not slow growth or no growth or anything. What they hate more than anything is uncertainty. And when you start a trade war or you saber rattle a trade war, that strikes fear in everyone and it causes people to sell. And that's why the stock market is off of its highs. So even if the administration is intent on going forward with these tariffs, they need to come out and soothe people's minds in some way. They need to show that diplomacy is working with China, that they are working towards a solution. They did do that a week or two ago, and it did help the market for one day. But then quickly things started to unravel once China retaliated. So they need to calm the fears of people, because if we can put this behind us, then businesses are going to start hiring more. They're going to start raising wages. They're going to push that GDP number above 3%. Heck, I'd love to see 4% or maybe even 5%, which is unthinkable. But we can do that after such a long period of stagnation. So I hope we can figure this out really soon.
Hopefully the waters will be calmed a bit going forward. We can get back to our growth cycle that we were in. Let's talk for our remaining minute or two here, Andy, about a special election. We kept a close eye on Pennsylvania 18, which went to the Democrats. The next special election coming up in a couple of weeks in Arizona. What's happening there?
Pennsylvania 18 race was what was once thought a reliably conservative district, but you're right, the Democrats picked that seat up. Arizona 8, by various metrics, is almost exactly the same conservative-wise as Pennsylvania 18. So you could say that Democrats have a shot because they were able to pick up Pennsylvania 18. But the planets aligned for them in Pennsylvania 18. They had a great candidate. Republicans had a less than stellar candidate. There was enthusiasm on the part of Democrats for a whole host of reasons. You're not seeing that in Arizona 8. I think the Republican candidate is very competent. She's very smart. She has a track record that people recognize and appreciate. So I think it should be fine for Republicans. But if the Democrats pick it up, then hold on to your hat because things are going to get pretty bad in November. And just to segue back to our previous conversation, if the Democrats pick up Arizona 8 and we continue to have these trade war problems, November's going to look just downright awful for Republicans. So let's hope that Republicans win Arizona 8. Let's hope the trade wars get behind us. And then I think we can be really hopeful for next November.
Well, we have 6 months left to go, so still plenty of time to right the ship, but we do have to get about doing that. Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union. And we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll check in with you again next week. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Over-aggressive use of asset forfeiture laws has spawned reform in a number of states. To get details, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice. Eric?
I don't care whether you're on the right or on the left, whether you're a firm supporter of the police or whether you're a critic of the cops. Regardless, I think we should all support policies that respect the rule of law and importantly, the idea that someone is innocent until proven guilty and that their property is also innocent until proven guilty. And that's exactly why this year we're seeing a broad left-right consensus around this idea of asset forfeiture reform. And if you haven't heard about that yet, well, we will explain it today on this edition of American Radio Journal. Thanks for joining us, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and my guest today is Lee McGrath. He is a senior legislative counsel with the Institute for Justice, a libertarian law firm that has been instrumental in passing asset forfeiture reform in a number of states. And Lee, you're an old friend of mine. Always glad to have you here. Thanks for being on the show.
Eric, my pleasure.
So for people who may not have heard about asset forfeiture reform, this is something that's kind of crossed over a little bit from libertarian organizations like yours and mine. I mean, we've been talking about this for years, obviously, but this is something that has crossed over, I think, more into the mainstream the last few years. But for our listeners who maybe haven't heard about it yet, what is asset forfeiture and why is it so in need of fixing?
Asset forfeiture is the power of the state to take your stuff. And so it is a legitimate government function. No one has the right to the fruit of crime. And so the real question is, what should be the guardrails around this awesome power of the police and prosecutors being able to take your stuff? Our efforts are all about reining in abuses and putting up guardrails so that people's property rights and due process rights are protected.
I think that's particularly true for our friends on the right. It's particularly important for us to say this, that look, this isn't an attack on a legitimate police work. As you said, Lee, no one is entitled to the proceeds of a crime. I would agree with that. If someone is caught and convicted of a crime, then I've got no problem with the government seizing what they got from that crime, those ill-gotten gains. But the problem is, and we've seen this everywhere, including right there in Minneapolis where you are, there was a high-profile case a number of years ago about a drug task force that was set up by the county, and they ended up going around targeting minorities, seizing their cars, seizing their cash and valuables. Jewelry was a frequent target, and, And oftentimes the people with whom, the people who they were taking this stuff from, they weren't even charging them with a crime, much less getting a conviction. And we've seen those same types of stories play out all over the country. And I think that's been a big part of helping spur these reforms that we're starting to see in state capitals now.
That's right, Eric. The problem is that in many states, you do not need to be convicted of a crime as a prerequisite to your losing your property through civil litigation in civil court under the umbrella of civil asset forfeiture. And so the one element of the reform effort that has now reached up to 28 states is to require a conviction, to require that someone be found guilty, and that, as a prerequisite to the question of whether the assets, the car, and the cash were the proceeds and the fruit of crime.
We're talking with Lee McGrath. He's a senior legislative counsel with the Institute for Justice, which has been involved in pushing reforms in a number of state capitals this year, reforms to civil asset forfeiture laws. Lee, there are several states here to talk about. We don't have that much time. I think maybe Idaho is the most significant one here, because this is a bill that was actually vetoed by the governor there last year. Then it passed again this year. Same governor. He signed the bill. And I think that kind of shows the trajectory of this issue.
That's exactly right, Eric. Last year, Governor Butch Otter vetoed a bill, but this year he signed the same exact one. And it received enormous support from legislators on both sides of the political aisle in the Idaho legislature. And it does some really good things. It bans forfeitures based on nothing more than minor drug possession. It sets up processes for people to get into court faster and challenge whether the seizure was constitutional, and it establishes a proportionality test. You can't take tens of thousands of dollars for a small amount of drugs or other evidence of crime.
Usually when we talk about asset forfeiture reform, we talk about requiring a conviction first, and I think that's an important thing. But that proportionality requirement that you mentioned, Lee, that seems important to me too. I remember there was an asset forfeiture case that IJ, I think it was, argued in Philadelphia a few years ago. It was a family that lost their house. They had a teenage son who was dealing drugs out of the bedroom. He got caught, and then they lost their entire house because of that. And I think anybody who looks at that would say, well, I mean, wait a minute, this doesn't really match. That seems like a disproportionate punishment. So that seems like an important element to include in there. We've only got about a minute left here. Quickly, give us a sense of what other states are working on reforms right now.
During this legislative session, since January 1st, we've seen good reforms enacted in Wyoming, Wisconsin, and a great reporting bill in Kansas. There are pending bills in Minnesota, Connecticut, and Missouri. And so there's a lot of activity going on, and it speaks to this core American idea that you are presumed innocent until found guilty, and so is your property.
And of course, if you're out there in one of those states and you happen to see your state lawmaker, state senator at some sort of community event like a parade or a picnic this spring, you know, maybe ask them where they stand on this issue. This is something that is happening in state capitals. It's something that lawmakers are talking about right now. And if you're in one of those other states, somewhere where reforms have already passed, maybe some congratulations are in order as well. And of course, some big congratulations to Lee and to the folks at IJ who have worked so hard and so far pretty successfully on this issue, a very important one. Lee, thanks so much for being here and talking to us about it.
Eric, thank you.
And again, that's Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice. He is their senior legislative counsel. You can check out more of their work on asset forfeiture reform and lots of other issues, economic liberty, First Amendment issues, all of that at IJ.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our work at Reason.com, and we'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A former CIA director who once voted for the Communist Party nominee for president is now hurling insults at President Trump. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College offers his view of that situation.
CBS's 60 Minutes recent Palm Sunday exclusive with porn star Stormy Daniels aired almost 20 years to the day of another surreal interview involving a president and sensational sexual allegations. On March 24, 1998, the New York Times provided a platform for one Bernard Lewinsky, father of a lady likewise infamous for lewd antics. And amazingly, Lewinsky exploded not at the man who employed his little girl, Monica, as a sexual plaything in the nation's most revered office, but instead at, well, Ken Starr. "I think this is just the drip torture technique that Ken Starr is using on her," complained the Los Angeles cancer specialist, condemning not Bill Clinton's grotesque techniques on his daughter. "He is just trying to torture her in every possible way." In a bizarre display of misguided venting and parenting, Monica Lewinsky's father directed his fire and fury not at the nation's obscene chief executive in the Oval Office sexually manipulating his child, that is, Bill Clinton, but at Ken Starr. Lewinsky barked at Starr, "Lay off!" These were words that surely would have been better spent hurled at Bill Clinton, eh, Dr. Lewinsky? But no. Dr. Lewinsky surmised that what Ken Starr, not Bill Clinton, had brought upon his daughter was, quote, unconscionable. Displaying his liberal bona fides, Dr. Lewinsky said the nefarious Starr so repulsed him that the counselor made him think of the worst of humans, Joe McCarthy. In fact, said Dr. Lewinsky, this new era was actually worse than that. The Starr era was reminiscent not merely of the McCarthy era, but of the Inquisition and even the Hitler era. Yes, the Hitlerian Ken Starr, said Dr. Lewinsky, was completely out of control. Again, no charges of Bill Clinton being out of control. So that was 20 years ago this time, and it's worth noting today because Dr. Lewinsky's comments weren't solely representative of an arranged father who had gone bananas thanks to Bill Clinton. No, Lewinsky was a proud liberal, and his misdirected indignation was reflective of liberals' misdirected indignation during the Clinton-Lewinsky affair. The liberal press wasn't simply in denial mode. It, too, was in attack mode. Recall how all the president's men joined the pack. The lieutenants in the Clinton camp were on a rampage. Ken Starr was a modern Torquemada. Clinton hatchet man James Carville lampooned Starr for, heaven forbid, praying and singing hymns during walks along a creek near his home. "He goes down by the Potomac and listens to hymns as the cleansing water of the Potomac goes by," screeched Carville. "And we're going to wash all the sodomites and fornicators out of town." Sidney Blumenthal snarled that Starr fancied himself, quote, "a zealot on a mission from a higher authority," unquote. Words like bimbo and trailer park trash were tossed around brutally by Clintonistas to besmirch women. Bill's victims might have started the hashtag MeToo movement if only a single pro-choice feminist in Washington had been willing to stand at their side. And now, 20 years later, where are we? Well, liberals are practically kicking down the door of the Playboy mansion looking under couches for dirt on Donald Trump. Suddenly, presidential morality matters. It seems only a matter of time before CNN sets up a full-time bureau in a Washington strip club. Poor Anderson Cooper seems to have been dispatched to the porn beat. Now, every new sexual allegation against Donald Trump is an instant headline. No hesitation. Straight to the front pages, baby. Is this hypocrisy by liberals? Oh, yes, you bet it is. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WDQN-AM in DuQuoin, Illinois. Welcome to our new listeners in the Prairie State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.